Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power, and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. Hello and welcome to the Americano show. Today I am delighted to be joined by Michael Robert Oslin, or Misha Oslin. I think we can call you Misha, is that right?
Indeed.
For the purposes of the show, you are Misha, but look up Michael Robert Oslin. He is a historian, a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and also the author of a new Substack, well, quite recent Substack, it's about a year old, called The Potomac Packet, which is all about Washington, D.C., and it is utterly fascinating. So I highly recommend it to all Americano listeners and indeed viewers. Michael, what we're going to be talking about today is China, because you're an expert on America-China relations. And while all the headlines in the last few days have been about Zelensky, Ukraine, deal or no deal, all the drama, all the diplomatic theatrics, this rather dramatic story came out of China yesterday, which was that quite a senior Chinese official responded to Donald Trump's tariffs with the following words: "Exerting extreme pressure on China is the wrong target and the wrong calculation," said China's foreign ministry spokesman Lin Jian. "If the US has other intentions and insists on a tariff war, trade war, or any other war, China will fight to the end. We advise the US to put away its bullying face and return to the right track of dialogue and cooperation as soon as possible." Now, that wasn't just Lin Yan that said that. It was then retweeted from the Chinese embassy in America's official account. And to people like me, who tend to be a bit apocalyptic, that did sound like a rather worrying escalation. Do you think it's a worrying escalation from China?
I don't, actually, Freddie, with, you know, full humility that anytime a historian tries to look forward, you know, we're immediately proven wrong. So, you know, this can be overtaken by events, as they say here in D.C., and, you know, at any moment. But I think there's a couple of different things to unpack with that. First, you know, the Chinese were not happy about the pressure that Donald Trump brought on them last time he was in office, and they've been living with those tariffs and what you could consider a trade war now for 8 years. You know, Trump put them on 2017, 2018, and now we're here in 2025. And for the most part, the tariffs have remained. So on the one hand, there's nothing new about being under pressure. They're responding in part to the fact that Trump announced new 10% tariffs, but that certainly wasn't as draconian as what the Canadians and the Mexicans suddenly faced with 25% tariffs, or Trump's initial threats of putting 100% tariffs on China. So on the one hand, I think, you know, they doth protest a little too much because they've already been living with tariffs for a long time, and it certainly wasn't as bad as it might have been advertised. That'd be number one. Number two, the bullying face comment, which is a great comment, you know, put off your bullying face, take off your bullying mask. If they want Donald Trump to take off the bullying mask, they're going to have to wait at least until he's out of office, because he's not going to take off the bullying mask. And they know he's not going to take off the bullying mask. That's part of, if not, you know, a central part of his modus operandi, which is to maximize any initial engagement or policy. And then I think work back to what is a more, if not reasonable, something that sides can live with. Again, the case being those tariffs they've lived with. The point you raise in terms of the quote on other types of war obviously is a warning over Taiwan, and just a general warning for the United States not to press its luck too much in the Indo-Pacific broadly, but more specifically in the area around the Chinese littoral, you know, its interests in the South China Sea and the East China Sea and the like. And that's a more interesting one to try to interpret. You know, Donald Trump is not a new and unknown quantity for them, right? They already have dealt with him. And they also undoubtedly had a sense that, you know, there was at least a chance he would come back, and then a 50-50 chance he would come back, and well, now he's back, right? So it's not like they're completely taken by surprise. What is different, potentially, of course, is this team, foreign policy team, versus the last team. But in general, you know, when you think about U.S. foreign policy and even the Biden foreign policy, it didn't change that much vis-a-vis China. So it's not like they're trying to lay down a marker with someone they don't know. I think what they are trying to do is basically send a non-subtle message that you've got a lot of problems on your plate. You're dealing with a whole host of issues, both at home and obviously in Europe and the Middle East. So don't add on to your troubles. And if you don't, we won't.
Well, you mentioned the whole host of other troubles. I thought my understanding of the Trump administration is that they are primarily concerned with China when it comes to the world stage, and that a lot of the thinking behind Ukraine and possibly even saying things about Vladimir Putin or accommodating Vladimir Putin in ways that really offend European politicians, often absurdly so, is that Russia and China have become closer as a result of the Ukraine war and the kind of Western front against Russia in Ukraine, and that a lot of people inside the Trump administration think that's a bigger concern in many ways than what happens with Ukraine. Am I right in thinking that, or am I overreading it?
Well, I think at the strategic level, you're right. Now, we will see eventually through their national security strategy how they frame what you just mentioned, this question of Russo-Chinese or Sino-Russian accommodation, alliance, community of interests, whatever you want to put it. I don't really think it's an alliance. I think it is much more tactical and much more opportunist. It's a very transactional relationship in which Russia, you know, does not enjoy any type of real leverage. I mean, bits here and there, maybe, and possibly in terms of oil and other natural resources, but it really doesn't otherwise. But we'll see, you know, how the Trump administration actually frames that and then articulates their hierarchy of strategic concerns. But that said, every U.S. administration, every president comes in with some level of vision of how he's going to try to interact with the world. And then almost immediately that is washed away by events, whether you look at George Bush, you look at George W. Bush, you look at Barack Obama, Joe Biden, all of them. And those are just the most recent ones. So the question of Ukraine has become prominent. Perhaps what the Trump administration wants to do is try to solve it in the sense of laying it to the side, get to the ceasefire that they keep talking about so things don't get worse. But that is something that unless you put boots on the ground to try to directly, materially influence that outcome, they're simply passive. Now, you know, both sides might agree to a ceasefire, but that's not something that the U.S. can impose in a way that, let's say, were they to want, the U.S. could intervene in a Sino-Philippines dispute in the South China Sea over the Scarborough Shoal or Fiery Reef or wherever, Fiery Cross Reef or wherever it is. So I think that every administration comes in wanting to shape the world, and then every administration winds up responding to the world. Do they see China then as the great long game? I would say yes on the foreign policy side, but I actually think everything is subordinated to this question of regaining control at home. And what this first, you know, 5-6 weeks now has shown to a degree that you cannot compare except with Franklin Roosevelt's first 100 days back in 1933, so, you know, almost 100 years ago, is an absolutely ferocious, all hands on deck attempt to wrestle back control over the government and extenuated, influence over the states to reform and revitalize the United States. And I think that was really the thrust of the president's State of the Union address, which was just the other night. It was, you know, a new golden age and pointing out the waste and pointing out the ways in which we as American, I think many Americans view it, we as a people have lost control over our government. We have a sort of functioning electoral system, but a no responsive governing mechanism to the wills and wishes of the people. And you saw that, for example, the polls that show that 80%+ of American voters, Americans, want to ban men from women's sports, and the Senate Democrats blocked that bill. That's the type of thing that Trump is most focused on. And all of the foreign elements need to be put into place. They need to, A, not get worse. They need to, B, be structured in a way that now help the U.S., whether it's tariffs that onshore production in the U.S. or ensuring that allies with which we have security commitments don't face a crisis that may force us to get to intervene, or protecting our borders from foreign influence abroad, whether that is smuggling of terrorists, smuggling of individuals, fentanyl, or the like. So I think, again, you know, trying to understand it, we have to understand it from this is absolutely an inside-out administration, meaning the focus is inside on the U.S. The outside is treated in ways that need to conform as much as possible to the U.S. preferences, so that you can rebuild the U.S.
I take that point entirely, and that makes a lot of sense to me. But I do wonder, when you're talking about the border, what also is going on in the Trump administration, it seems to me, when it comes to foreign policy, is a more traditional great power concern about the Western Hemisphere. And particularly you see this with the Panama Canal, you see it with Canada, you see it perhaps with the desire to buy Greenland, which seems quite sincere. But let's talk about the Panama Canal for a second. I mean, that very much was an attempt to eject Chinese influence from Latin America, Central America. And that does seem to be something the State Department's very concerned about. Marco Rubio seems concerned about. Mike Waltz, National Security Advisor, seems concerned about too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a domestic element, which is the question of shipping, the question of ensuring freedom of transit through the canal, the costs that were being paid. And of course, you just saw yesterday that the port operator is going to sell the control of those two ports on either side of the Panama Canal to a consortium headed by BlackRock, or in which BlackRock, the investment firm, is heavily involved. And so there is movement. Now, of course, when President Carter agreed to the transfer of the Panama Canal, there wasn't the concern that China would somehow control it. You know, that's something that evolved. And I think, you know, in many ways that shows the responsiveness of the Trump administration to changed situations. You know, China may or may not be able to control the Strait of Malacca. They certainly don't want to see the U.S. control the Strait of Malacca. And I think the analog is the same in the Panama Canal situation. And, you know, so what we're seeing is a revival of the Monroe Doctrine. You know, now maybe we're going to call it the Monroe-Trump Doctrine. I don't know. But it's, you know, it is clearly an effort to reassert the question of national interest. Greenland, which, you know, Trump is not the first one to have brought this up, I think falls into that category as well, in terms of questions of geopolitics, of control of strategic lines, you know, of communication, you know, maritime lines of communication and the like. So there's no doubt that they see that the U.S. has lost a lot of space around the world in their view. And the broader question, which honestly, we're really not, there's a few people here in Washington who look at it as carefully as it should be, but the dramatic expansion of Chinese influence and power in Latin America is something that we absolutely should have tried to address long ago, and we really didn't. And so I think what they are doing is they see this all rather, you know, holistically, if I can, you know, put it that way. They really do think that the things that are abroad are significant when they affect our ability, again, to rebuild at home. And I think, you know, you might want to look at it in terms of concentric circles. You know, so we've got a concentric circle of the Panama Canal is very close. Greenland's pretty close. We'll leave aside Canada. You know, that's a whole different issue. That's really, really close. But let's, you know, leave that aside. And then, you know, then the question of our commitments and alliances and friendships, you know, whether it's Europe or Asia, and obviously the concern about the Middle East, which can really upend, you know, a lot of strategic assumptions should Iran get a nuclear weapon, what that does in terms of nuclear proliferation, what it does in terms of guarantees to Israel and the like. You know, Israel has, you know, in many ways rewritten the strategic map of the Middle East over the last, you know, year and a half since October 7th. But an Iranian nuclear bomb would throw a lot of that into question and would absolutely drag in the United States. So I do think there's a, you know, a method to the madness, if you want to put it that way. And very interestingly, you use the term great power. And I think we are in that environment again, which is a pre-1945 great power strategic global environment, as opposed to superpower. Now, without question, the U.S. remains the most dominant. I mean, for example, you just look at, you know, when Trump threatens to pull out of NATO, there's a reason that it has resonance. The U.S. provides more than 80% of the military heft of NATO. So the U.S. remains a superpower. And yet the way in which I think they're approaching the world is a little bit more of a great power conception of it. Not that it necessarily turns into blocks where you say, okay, the China bloc controls Asia, the Russia bloc controls Europe, and whatever it is, the Turkish bloc or the Iranian bloc controls the Middle East. But I do think that they are seeing it that, look, the United States, there are limitations to what we can do. As powerful as we are, maybe if you rebuild economic strength, then some of those limitations are mitigated, and so we can act, you know, even more around the world. But I think that the appetite for that has reduced, and that's really what that struggle over Ukraine indicates. It is, you know, is this an open-ended war? I mean, Zelensky the other day said the war is going to go on for a long, long time. Is this open-ended, where the U.S. simply provides billions upon billions of dollars every year of aid without any type of resolution? Or do you try to acknowledge that there are certain outcomes that you are less likely to achieve, and therefore you're trying to get a best, not perfect, outcome in the world? That is a little bit more of, I think, a pre-1945 view of the United States. The post-1945 view of the United States was really, we're going to reshape the world entirely. We're going to dominate that world. We're going to create all these structures. And even though not everyone's going to be on board with it, it's really going to drive global development. I'm not sure that that is the view anymore. And I don't think just necessarily amongst the Trump tribe, but more broadly, that we recognize the limitations and you have to make best do with that. And that, again, I would say, Freddie, is, you know, for example, where the question of Taiwan comes into place. You know, can you live in a world in which Taiwan is dominated by China? Well, geographically and geopolitically, sure. In terms of semiconductor chips, probably not. So what Trump has been doing, and you saw the TSMC announcement just this week, $500 billion invested in the U.S., is try to change that geopolitical equation. It's not that we shouldn't support a democracy like Taiwan attempting to maintain its sovereignty. I believe we should support it. That's fine. What that means is a whole different policy debate. But removing the stranglehold that a TSMC that produces 90% of the world's semiconductor chips has on United States' ability to, for example, try to make maybe a modus vivendi with China, or simply try not to get dragged in to fights that are halfway around the world and for which we would be very strained militarily, by the way. As our commander of Indo-Pacific Command has warned, China is planning for war. Now, what does that actually mean? If you can reduce some of that geopolitical uncertainty, then it gives you more ability to act and shape in the world than if you are essentially hijacked by a what you know people might like to call a single point failure. Meaning all the world's chips are produced in Taiwan. Taiwan is at risk. Therefore, everything else has to be structured around that. So I think that the problem we face and the problem Trump faces at home and abroad, and we, you know, we could get into it if you want, but just to sum this up, is that we live in a world shaped now by decades of accretion of structures, institutions, commitments, alliances, and quite frankly, mindsets. The argument is that those are no longer fit for purpose in the world in which we live, which you can accept easily or accept with you know difficulty. But when you accept it, the real question is, okay, now what do you do about it? How do you unwind those commitments? How do you unwind them to make it more fit for the world in which you live? Certainly that's the fight going on at home in America, that our government is not responsive in any real way to the people anymore. And the hundreds of billions of dollars of fraud and waste that they found just show that. Abroad is the same question. So, I mean, obviously I could go on about this, but what I'm trying to do is just explain how I think they're approaching this question and why they've gotten themselves into this set of policy preferences that seem very radical, but only are radical if you say that, well, everything's been perfect and you just are simply upsetting the apple cart for no reason. That, I think, is not the case.
That makes sense to me. I just, when you were talking there, I was just thinking about how when you look at the BRICS, that's not a pre-1945 alliance. That is quite a modern, quite a sort of almost multilateral and very world covering alliance, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. I mean, is the danger then not for America that it is withdrawing from these sort of more multilateral alliances, this more post-1945 worldview, just as China, its biggest strategic threat, is beginning to form in its own view and in Russia's view, and perhaps in India's, a new world order?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question. And I would say, first, you know, even in the Cold War, of course, you had blocs, right? You had the non-aligned movement, and you had a lot of the world, you know, didn't join with the U.S., nor did they join with Russia. It's not that you had just, you know, two superpowers, one a complete superpower and one a military superpower, fighting for dominance. So you always had that. And so in some way, the BRICS is both pre and post 1945. It's pre 1945 in the sense of, you know, a group of nations coming together, you know, the Holy Roman Alliance, the alliance, the Triple Alliance, or, you know, whatever it is, the three crowns coming together. I'm just blanking, of course, on the exact historical term, which I know everyone's screaming it out right now. But anyway,
the Holy Roman Empire.
Not the Holy Roman Empire, but the Austria, Hungary, Prussia, and Russia, the alliance. That Bismarck.
The Triple Entente.
The Triple Entente. So no, I mean we've had post 1945 and pre 1945 blocs. What I think with China and the BRICS is interesting is actually how little it's accomplished. We've had the BRICS for, you know, a long time. What have they really done? And people now are, there's another term that's out there. I forget that the something else that's another acronym. You know, you can look at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as another regional attempt that really didn't go anywhere. you know, they meet, but what does it really do, and how does it really structure things? So I think a lot of the concern we had over China building alternative systems, it's not that we should ignore it, but I think we also need to recognize that it hasn't overturned Bretton Woods. It hasn't overturned the World Bank. Maybe it's parallel in some ways to the Asian Development Bank. When you look at the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank that the Chinese set up, there's a lot of different aspects to what China or Russia or Iran or Turkey are doing. But, you know, the ways in which they have really fundamentally changed the carrying trade or a settlement of, you know, of international bills or the running of the internet. Sure, there's chips chipping away at that base, but really not much has changed. And so I think we should be less worried maybe about the sort of grand restructuring of the global environment than with the specific sets of interests that drive nations to take actual material actions, i.e. Russia in Ukraine, or let's say China in vis-a-vis Taiwan.
And I mean, I suppose one thing that ties these countries together is economic interests, obviously. And perhaps a threat there would be the dollar. And that would be a major shift in global power dynamics were the BRICS sort of able to form a rival to the dollar, which is probably where they're going to go.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, it's a long time that this has been talked about. I'm not an economist or a global economist, and so I look at it like, you know, most folks who are more concerned with the politics and the security issues do. You know, China is moving forward, or certainly has indicated a long-term interest in moving forward to a central bank digital currency. That could be more of a change. There has been some level of decline, and I can't tell you offhand because I don't look at that specifically, in settlement in yuan, you know, renminbi versus dollar, you know, but for the most part, the dollar remains the world's reserve currency. You know, whether that indicates that everyone else is in worse shape than the U.S. is, or whether it's a long-term bet on the state of the U.S., you know, you haven't seen a flood out. And we always talk about it, whether the sense of that, you know, the debt is unsustainable and therefore, you know, sell your debt instruments. And, you know, China, and, you know, has reduced some. Japan fluctuates, you know, whether it's $1 billion, $1 trillion or whatever it is. The truth is the vast majority of our debt is held by the United States, right? It's held by the Federal Reserve. It's held by us. And so that's why we can keep interest rates relatively low. It's why we can continue to print the dollar. It's not that we suddenly are faced with a situation in which everyone is running to the renminbi. You can't, because it's not convertible. It you can't hold it the way that you hold the dollar. And quite honestly and rightfully, the world doesn't trust China. You know, that there's bountiful evidence of why you don't trust China with your money, because quite frankly, the Chinese don't trust China and the government with their money. That's why they've been offshoring as much as they can. It's why they buy real estate. It's why they send their kids abroad. So there's a lot of reasons to, you know, to not worry overly yet. It's not to say the U.S. shouldn't get its fiscal house in order. It needs to, and it must, but it's not because, you know, tomorrow the dollar disappears. It's just a much longer term trend. But I think your question points to this issue of whether or not other countries have been able to come up with meaningful and effective international institutions and organizations. And for the most part, I think the answer is no. That's why the Chinese focus on inserting themselves into positions of influence, if not dominance, over the international non-governmental organizations, such as those set up by the UN. Now, you could call it a two-tier approach, right? On the one hand, they're trying to infiltrate and dominate the UN-style international non-governmental organizations, and at the same time, build things like the BRICS or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But really, when you look at most of China's effort, it's on dominating the sort of, whether you want to call it, you know, Dumbarton Oaks style international organizations, because those are the really effective ones, on telecommunications, on global health, on international civil aviation, all of those different things. Law of the sea, those are the ones that China tries to dominate. So, you know, for the Trump administration, attempting to ensure that your strategic focus and therefore your economic focus is really on the true threats abroad, because what you want to do again is focus at home, in many ways makes a lot of sense. You know, if this were, you know, 2023 and you're talking about cutting off aid to Ukraine, you know, people would, I think, rightfully say, well, you know, the war has just started, you know, terrible thing, right? But it's just started. You know, when you're 3 years down the road in what looks increasingly like a 1914 situation of just entrenched armies along lines of control with very little movement and just butchery, then is it right to start looking at alternatives to that status quo? And people like, you know, the late Henry Kissinger from the very beginning talked about negotiated settlements. You know, he came under a lot of criticism for saying Ukraine is going to have to give up some of the territory that it's already lost because it's not feasible that it's going to get it back without extraordinary cost. And he's been proved right. So it's really interesting to see the split then between the Trump administration and I would say many in the U.S., and the European leadership, which seems to be doubling and tripling down. And of course, Prime Minister Starmer just made some extraordinary commitments to Ukraine. But within 24 hours of those, Zelensky was coming back to Trump saying, I'll sign the minerals agreement and we need to get you back involved in the process. So whether that's some type of recognition that European commitments may not be able to resolve this the way that Ukraine would like, or a sense that even if they can, you still need the United States there. I think the leverage really lies with the Trump administration right now.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think Keir Starmer's administration, as much as I have insight into it, is sort of speaking out of both sides of its mouth, because it's simultaneously encouraging Zelensky to fold on the deal while saying we'll stand up for you and so on. But what you were, just to go back a bit, what you were talking about China and sort of bodies affiliated with the UN, that leads me to think about climate change. And there's been quite a lot of interesting work that's been done recently exposing the extent to which China is behind a lot of the climate change lobby in Europe and America, and that it sees strategic leverage in making climate change something that America preoccupies itself with in terms of policy, and Europe too, while it continues to churn out far more carbon emissions than ever. That's a key part of this story, is it not?
I think what the Trump administration is doing, which is facing a lot of resistance from people, again, because I think of the accretion of above all mindsets and ways of seeing the world, is a very painful, you know, use your metaphor, a very painful ripping off of the bandage, or a very painful ripping off of the mask, or, you know, pulling the curtain back to show the man, the little man behind the curtain, that a lot of what we thought had its own validity really didn't. And so whether it's USAID spending hundreds of billions of dollars to push climate change issues, or to push issues related to you know, lifestyles around the world or things like that, or whether it's China doing it, what people interpreted as essentially good faith campaigns are, at least to some degree, being revealed as very cold and calculating political campaigns. That's what I meant about the mindsets. Everyone came in for decades saying, you know, global warming and global change and whatever, climate change, we have to deal with this because it's a threat to the future. And then you find out that so much of this was funded by groups committed to it, as opposed to a an impartial reading of the science. Same thing with the vaccines. And you saw the I don't know if you saw, but yesterday the nominee for the head of the National Institutes of Health, Stanford scientist Dr. Bhattacharya, Jay Bhattacharya, was basically talking about how so much misinformation had been funded, which is exactly turning the tables on the supposed misinformation of those who had skepticism. As well as the fact that, by the way, people like Senator Tom Cotton were excoriated and were absolutely denigrated for suggesting back in 2020 that COVID leaked from a lab, not necessarily intentionally, but that it leaked from a lab. And now that is more or less the common wisdom, as it should have been from the very beginning. You know, when John Stewart says that, you know, that makes sense, that's the most likely explanation, I think the rest of us can then, you know, happily come on board with it, right? So it's a fascinating, and I understand and agree, unsettling, if not terrifying moment to confront all these shibboleths, but then find out that they were all Potemkin villages, that there was no international, it is an unsettling, if not frightening, thing to confront all these shibboleths and realize there was no real international constituency for it. And what international consensus there was bought and paid for. That's what DOGE is finding out. Hundreds of billions of dollars laundered through hundreds, if not thousands, of different pop-up shell NGOs. That's the latest thing that they've discovered. Getting $7 billion for climate change issues, which is utterly and totally unaccounted for. So if you really do believe in science or believe in facts, then at least it would be an interesting game to play this out. Let Trump and Doge and Musk have their way and then see what actually happens. Because what their judgment is and what they're trying to tell us in essence is that everything that you were brought up to believe itself was disinformation. And when they told you it was disinformation, that was disinformation, true Orwellianism. And that was jumped on and abetted by our enemies, our adversaries like China. Why wouldn't they? Of course you would. Why wouldn't Russia? Why wouldn't Iran? They would be stupid not to basically walk through the door that we had opened and cause dissension within our communities, cause a political paralysis, cause an enormous waste of money. I mean, we have wasted hundreds of... Americans are living in tents in Western North Carolina because after Hurricane Helene, the Biden administration essentially washed their hands of them and left them alone while they sent tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars to Ukraine and for climate change and for vaccination stuff. That's why 70%+ of people who watched Trump's State of the Union agreed with it. And that's a CBS poll. That's not a Fox poll. That's a CBS poll. We may be at a point, it's almost like if you've ever read The Structure of Scientific Paradigms, a famous book, where you have one way of viewing the world, and then there is a radical shift to viewing a different way of the world. I think that we may be getting to that new shift, which in itself is a shift backwards. 10 years ago, nobody talked about trans in the way that we do today. And you did not. No one would have allowed a boy to compete against a girl, let alone harm a girl in sports, which has happened over and over and over. But there was a radical worldview shift just in an eye blink in the space of a few years that suddenly said that all this is normal. And now Trump is trying to reverse that. And those like, you know, Javier Milei, Nayib Bukele in El Salvador, and maybe Giorgia Meloni in Italy are also on board trying to reverse that. And it is upsetting everything. The resistance is extraordinary. I don't understand that the Democratic Party in the United States has essentially reduced itself to two propositions. Men should be in women's sports, and we will fight an endless open war for Ukraine forever without any sense of how it can be won. That's what the Democratic Party is today. And the fighting is vicious because it's not just saying it's a policy. What Trump is trying to do is change a worldview. And I'm not saying that everything he's doing is necessarily right or correct, but I'm saying that that's what he's essentially doing. We saw a little bit of this, you know, in his first term, even though he made deals with China, when he was basically saying, look, China's the adversary. And the national security strategy said they were the adversary. And other statements that came out of that first administration said they're the adversary. What that did was upend 40 years of consensus about China. And it was very unsettling. And there were a lot of people, a lot of China experts and people very invested in the China relationship who wrote op-eds and signed op-eds in the Washington Post and other places saying China's not the enemy. And Trump said, no, they are the enemy. We might try to make a deal with them, but you have to understand they're the enemy. And that upended 40 years. Now, in the second term, with basically, you know, no restraints whatsoever on his own sense of what he wants to achieve, he's doing that across the board. He's not the only one to say vaccinations were problematic. I mean, he loved the vaccination. He did Operation Warp Speed under his administration, but he's not the first one to say that you need transparency on this. He's certainly not the first one to say that there are questions about climate change. And he's definitely not the first one to say that you can't have an open-ended war in Ukraine. Henry Kissinger and others said that. So, but what he's doing is doing it all at once. It is a tornado, a tsunami of the like that we honestly haven't seen since at least 1933, and maybe ever, because I don't know if Franklin Roosevelt tried to change the mindset as much as he simply said, we're going to use every tool at our disposal to create a new governing structure and sort of a new compact between the government and the citizen. You know, that's in response to the Great Depression. Trump's doing something in a way much more profound. And they didn't do it piece by piece or piecemeal. They did it in a blitzkrieg. And that's why everyone is shocked. And that's why everyone has not had the time mentally or intellectually to absorb it, I think, and say, wait a second, what does make sense and what doesn't make sense? And when you're talking about an intractable issue like a China that is not going to give up its goals, its preferences, its demands for influence, and layer that on top of all of this, then suddenly you get to this point where you think, my God, everything's spinning out of control. And that's not necessarily the wrong interpretation. It is spinning out of control in the sense of what tried to be controlled was false in a way. You couldn't control a China to make it into your partner because China didn't want to be your partner. Right. So it's almost a complete, it's not just an epistemological change. It's almost an ontological change. What is reality? What you thought was reality really wasn't. And Trump is doing stuff that that honestly, I did never expect any politician to do. And I'm not saying they're doing it perfectly or that they understand it all. But they are really essentially saying that the world in which you thought you lived was in many ways a false world. So now we have to find that right world. And I'll wind up because I know I've been rambling on about this, but you sort of opened the door to it. There's a very old Chinese concept called rectification of names. It's a Confucian concept. And really what it basically means is bringing your understanding of the world into conformity with reality, meaning you can have a name for something that does not actually reflect what that is, you know, calling night day. You can call night day, but that means the name is wrong and it means your understanding of the world is wrong. And so there's a very, very millennial long tradition in Confucian thought that when things get out of whack, when it becomes clear that you're not responding in effective ways to what's happening and you're wondering why that is, you need a rectification of names. Very simply, you need to call things what they are. And whether you agree with him or not, I think that's what Donald Trump is doing. He even dropped the sort of qualifying term biological men in his State of the Union speech, where some people are trying to say, well, we're going to ban biological men from women's sports. He said, no, we're banning men. You don't need to parse it and define it. Until 5 minutes ago, everyone in the world, for all of human history, understood what a man was and what a woman was. And it wasn't particularly controversial. People could live their lives the way they wanted, but you didn't fool yourself into calling a man a woman. He's trying to rectify names. China's not a partner. It's an adversary at best and an enemy at worst. He's rectifying names. When you do that, it has inherent policy implications, and that's where it becomes just as difficult. I actually think it's very difficult to rectify names. But then there's an added level of difficulty because you are now trying to reorient your world to the reality that you have now accepted, what actually is reality, as opposed to imputing a reality that really isn't there.
Misha,
that was long. Sorry.
No, I was about to say you weren't rambling at all. That is one of the most brilliant attempts to swim through the flooded zone that we are living in, and I'm extremely grateful to you for it. Thank you very much for coming on to an Americano, and I think we need to talk again soon as this apple cart keeps being turned over.
Absolutely, it's always a pleasure to come on. And in a confusing world, The Spectator remains for me one of the true anchors every week when it comes out, because being honest and yet doing it with panache and a sense that you at least have to laugh your way through some of this is absolutely critical. So I thank you for letting me come on and talking to folks.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening to it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.